Names synonymous with the spirit of our country, founding fathers of the USA. Over 200 years ago, they shook off the chains of tyranny from Great Britain by divine call. Citing 27 biblical violations, they wrote the Declaration of Independence with liberty and justice for all. But something happened since Jefferson called the Bible the cornerstone for American liberty, then put it in our schools as a light. Or since Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death, Patrick Henry said, our country was founded on the gospel of Jesus Christ. We eliminated God from the equation of American life, thus eliminating the reason this nation first began. From beyond the grave, I hear the voices of our founding fathers plead, you need God in America again. Of the 55 men who formed the Constitution, 52 were active members of their church. Founding fathers like Noah Webster, who wrote the first dictionary, could literally quote the Bible chapter and verse. James Madison said, we've staked our future and our ability to follow the Ten Commandments with all our heart. These men believed you couldn't even call yourself an American if you subvert the word of God. In his farewell address, Washington said, you can't have national morality apart from religious principles, and it's true. Because right now we have nearly 150,000 kids carrying guns for these war zones we call public schools. In the 40s and 50s, student problems were chewing gum and talking. In the 90s, rape and murder were the trend. The only way this nation can even hope to last this decade is for God in America. Than clean it, it's the sign that judgment of God is going to fall. If there's ever been a time to rise up, church, it's now. And as the blood-bought saints of the living God proclaim, it's time to sound the alarm from the church house to the White House and say, we want God in America again.
Thank you. Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because we have with us Dr. Colin Ross, and we're going to be talking about Bluebird. We're going to be talking about, really, Operation Bluebird, a CIA operation that was designed to study about how you could create mental illness in unsuspecting Americans. And, of course, this is based, well, I'm going to let him tell you how he got into this. It's a fascinating study. Dr. Ross is a psychiatrist. He's practicing. He's been dealing with this for 20 years. And his story is, well, something every American should hear. Good evening. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself? I know you were graduated in Canada, but just sort of give us a quick rundown, and then how you got involved in dealing with dissociative personalities, and really what a dissociative personality is.
Okay. Well, I always wanted to be a psychiatrist since I was a kid, actually. And I took a sort of roundabout route, ended up getting to medical school, and finished medical school, and then went into psychiatry. When I was a third-year medical student, I was doing my rotation in psychiatry, and I independently diagnosed somebody as having multiple personality disorder. And that's really... I was kind of very, very vaguely aware of it before that, and that's how I got interested in it. And I just read literature and started writing about it myself, and there's no looking back from that point on.
Well, now, explain to our listeners, will you please, what is a dissociative personality?
Well, it used to be called multiple personality disorder, like Sybil and the Three Faces of Eve, and then in 94, the name was officially changed to dissociative identity disorder. Same thing, basically.
Well, are these people with really two entirely different personalities?
Well, yes and no. It's not literally true that there's more than one person living inside the same body, or that there's more than one person there. But their identities are fractured or fragmented into these different people, quotes, who take turns being in control of the body and don't always remember what the other ones have been doing.
And, of course, this really is the personality's response to a deal with something that is just too horrible to contemplate. Is that would be a fair statement?
Yeah, it's basically a survival coping strategy when there's too much abuse, neglect, violence, chaos, trauma going on in childhood. The basic idea is simple, just, this is too much, I'm out of here, somebody else can deal with this.
All right. Now, of course, the difficult thing for, I think, many people to understand is that the Central Intelligence Agency, many years ago, set out to figure out how they could create this sort of a situation in people, and they actually contracted with psychiatrists and medical schools to actually create personality disorders in their patients. And, of course, these studies were done. They were published in peer-reviewed journals. And the amazing thing is nobody seemed to think there was anything wrong with creating mental disease.
It is very amazing. And I first got into this when I moved from Canada to Dallas in late 91. And early in 92, some patients started to tell me stories. And that one actually gave me some declassified documents about, as kids, being on bases or being in hospitals and having very odd scientific experiments done on them with EEG machines, LSD, physical spinning, memorization experiments, sensory deprivation, wearing strange goggles and so on, you know, all to create these new artificial identities, basically create an artificial multiple personality. And so, of course, I didn't know whether that was real or not real, or what to think of it, really. And I decided to start doing a whole lot of reading and research. And that's how I got it, to writing the book, Bluebird.
Well, now, of course, a lot of this was based upon information you got from the Central Intelligence Agency and the Freedom of Information Act, isn't it?
Yeah, I have around about 15,000 pages of documents from the CIA from Freedom of Information. And then I've got a whole cabinet full of papers mostly from the 50s and 60s that I photocopied from medical journals. In the medical journals, it really stops in the early 70s, but up until the early 70s, you can read all kinds of insane experiments, LSD experiments, electroshock, all kinds of unusual things. And it'll say at the bottom of the paper, funded by the Office of Naval Research or the Department of the Army or the Office of Naval Research. So I was able to document very extensive funding of all kinds of mind control experiments. And then they never quite had the gall to put in the medical journals that was funded by the CIA. But I got all of that from the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, of course, the thing was that they were using hypnosis and drugs, and they were using electric shock, various types of trauma-based affairs to actually create mental illness in people just to see what would happen. What about the ethics of something like that?
Well, there are no ethics. There's several angles I take on this. I'm basically not an anti-government or anti-CIA guy as such. I'm really a civilian psychiatrist. My focus is on psychiatry, mental illness, how to help patients, and the ethics of psychiatry. And this is basically an absolutely documented, systematic, pervasive violation of human rights and basic medical ethics by all the major leading medical schools, many of the grandfathers of psychiatry, throughout the second half of the 20th century. So I was always told about, in the Soviet Union, they abused psychiatry for political purposes, and they put people in jail when they're just political radicals, or put them in mental hospitals and pretend they're mentally ill, and we never do that there. It was a very holier-than-thou kind of attitude. But we, North American psychiatry, have done horrendous things to patients without really following them systematically to see the harm, without real informed consent, and really up to the level of Nazi atrocities.
Well, didn't we actually bring some of the Nazi psychiatrists who'd done these macabre things in their concentration camps to America under Operation Paperclip and allow them to continue their studies here?
Well, that's something I want to find out more about. And what happened at the end of the Second World War is, as the war was winding down, a lot of the German scientists were being captured and put in camps and so on. And then immediately after the war, there was a big scramble between the Russians, French, Germans, British and Americans, to get all these scientists and bring them back home. And the problem that the U.S. had was a lot of them were documented Nazi war criminals, so therefore the State Department wouldn't issue them visas. So they set up a series of programs, the most famous of which is Paperclip, to bring these people over, basically routing them around the State Department visa requirements. This included Wernher von Braun, the major figures in the NASA rocket team, medical doctors, all kinds of propulsion, ball bearing, film, aviation experts of all kind. The only people who are missing from the documentation is the psychiatrist. And there had to have been psychiatrists in the group. So that's something I would like to see brought out in public and documented.
No, like I think, of course, they really don't want the American people to realize the crass indifference to humanity. Really, the Operation Paperclip, and for our listeners who don't know what it was, this was the symbol, if you were working in intelligence and you saw one of these files, and they always put a paperclip on it, that meant that they were to be passed over and brought into this country, ignoring their crimes against humanity under the Nazi regime.
Right.
Of course, it was felt that, well, we need these people here because, after all, we're involved now in the war with the evil communists, and so we have to bring in these evil people to help us fight the evil communists. And
well, even if you bought that argument, which I don't exactly buy, the problem is, from a medical ethics point of view, these people come over to the country, and then they massively violate basic medical ethics, and everybody looks the other way, doesn't comment, and lets it slide by. That's what really makes me angry.
Well, the thing is, it was not only the Nazis, but these were Americans. A lot of these were American psychiatrists trained in our schools with relativism, where right and wrong, really, well, there really is no right and no wrong. And so, some of the things in your book where you actually quote from the CIA files about these psychiatrists using electric shock just to see what would happen. What it really wasn't called for, using excessive electric shock. That was and intentionally trying to destroy memory or destroy personalities.
Well, they were very successful, and overusing really understates it. And Linda McDonald, who's a very well-documented case from McGill University, which is in Montreal, which is basically the leading Canadian university and was the leading Canadian medical school and department of psychiatry. The head of the department, Ewan Cameron, was a CIA contractor. That's all documented. He was the guy who founded the World Psychiatric Association. He was president of the Canadian and American Psychiatric Associations. Very well-connected guy politically. And he was part of the team that went over and interviewed all of the Nazi doctors for the Nuremberg trials. And by the time Linda McDonald arrived at the hospital in 1963, the CIA funding had dropped out and was picked up by the Canadian government.
No, this was up in Canada. No.
Yeah, in McGill. And because most of the CIA contracting was done in the United States, some in Canada, some overseas. The overseas was mostly under a program called MK Delta, and the U.S. and Canadian was under MK Ultra. But at any rate, Linda McDonald came into the hospital, and under funding from the Canadian government, he gave her between, she was admitted in March, but the actual shock therapy started in May.
Now, this is Dr. Cameron, of course, the psychiatrist, the prominent Canadian psychiatrist.
Yeah, and he started from May to September. He gave her 102 shock treatments, each of which delivered 6 times the normal dose of electricity to her brain. On top of that, kept her asleep for weeks with drugs and played tape loops to her over and over and over and over and over. At the end of this period of time, she was incontinent of urine and feces, didn't know her name, didn't know where she was, didn't know what year it was, couldn't recognize her husband or her children. And she gradually, over a period of 3-6 months, got back her normal abilities and was able to function.
But she didn't have any memory.
Absolutely no memory of from the time she was admitted to the hospital back to birth, from 1963 until the present. She hasn't recovered any of that memory at all. So this is just Nazi-level experiments to wipe out somebody's memory, done on contract to the CIA, obviously.
Without the knowledge or consent of the individual.
No real consent.
And certainly with the full knowledge of psychiatrists, it wasn't just Dr. Cameron. Obviously, the people in your Canadian government had to know about it. And certainly the CIA probably knew about it, didn't they?
And, well, yeah, they didn't only know about it, they paid for it. And why an intelligence agency would want to figure out how to wipe out somebody's memory didn't take too long to figure out, right? But the just most appalling thing is not only did doctors in the government, other doctors in McGill know about it, but it was published in mainstream medical journals, American Journal of Psychiatry, Comprehensive Psychiatry. It's just like the Tuskegee syphilis study, which was published in mainstream medical journals. And I have a copy of that was a study that started in 1942, where 400 black guys in the rural South who all had syphilis were prevented from having any treatment. And the study was finally shut down under public protest in 1972. And it was run by the Center for Disease Control, U.S. Department of Public Health. The Surgeon General knew about it. The American Heart Association knew about it.
But, of course, for our listeners out there, these were 400 black men who had syphilis who, of course, were recruited for a study. And they were told they were going to be treated for their bad blood, as it were.
Right.
But they really weren't being recruited to be treated. They were recruited not to be treated.
Right.
So they could just find out what syphilis would do to ravage their bodies and destroy their
minds. And lo and behold, they found out that these guys died earlier and had more illness. And the results of the journal, I have a 1965 article called Untreated Syphilis in the Male Negro from a mainstream medical journal. And this violated absolutely all ethical conventions going back to Nuremberg. But it was the nurse who was the main person running the study.
Nurse Rivers.
Yeah, she received a Lifetime Service Award from the Public Health Service.
She refused it or she received it?
She received it.
She received it for this great work. She was black, and she betrayed all these black men. And of course, every time they would go into a clinic any place to try to get treatment, she would, of course, carry out her orders. She was just carrying out her orders.
Right.
She would notify them that these were special people, they were not to be treated. And of course, what happened was that the fellow, in fact, a friend, a gentleman I've interviewed many times, Peter Buxton, mm-hmm. Who was working as doing venereal disease histories while waiting to get into law school, working at the public health clinic in San Francisco, heard about this, and he was horrified.
Right.
And so he wrote some letters. Well, that's an entirely different story, but he wrote letters back.
Basically, it was him as an individual that brought this out into public and got the study shut down. It was one man.
One man. And, of course, what was really so frightening to me about this, Dr. Ross, though, was that CDC convened a group of professors from medical schools, and there were 11 of them. And said, is there anything immoral about, you know, this wonderful scientific experiment? Think all we're going to learn about this, just withholding intensely treatment for a treatable disease.
Right.
And 10 of them said there was nothing wrong with it. One man stood up and said, this is immoral. What you're doing is wrong. But the other 10, and they're the people that we look to as the leaders of organized medicine and medical teaching, and these are the people who are teaching our doctors, about ethics. And they said there's nothing wrong with it. And it wasn't until the public found out that this thing stopped.
Exactly. And that's the climate that allows all this mind control experimentation to go on. It's a look the other way, don't rock the boat, might be bad for my career if I say anything. Or, gee, maybe I might want to get one of those grants sometime myself, and I see that the guys who get those grants get promotions. That's the way the whole system works, basically.
Well, you can't be very, very popular having, written a number of books on this subject. But for our listeners out there, Dr. Ross's book, and we carry it, is called Bluebird. And it did take off on the name Operation Bluebird, one of the first CIA mind control experiments. And then, of course, it became Artichoke, and it became, I've forgotten, what they
MK
started,
Ultra, right, and MK Search.
And they keep changing the name, so you can't figure out what they're really doing. But there are a lot of these victims out all across America. Now, let's talk about Linda. How did they ever find out what really happened, and what did eventually happen to her?
Well, exactly why there's a, from when I was doing all the background reading for this, I learned a bit about how CIA operates and how intelligence operates. And I learned some of their jargon. So there's one thing they do is called a limited hangout. It's a disinformation strategy. So they let out a little part of the truth in order to cover up the greater part. So they say, hey, we came clean, here's all there is. Okay, that's it. Now we're not going to do that anymore. But actually, it's a deliberate strategy to keep the other 95% hidden. And so I'm thinking, I can't prove, I have no documents at all, but I'm thinking that somehow there was a decision to do a limited hangout with Ewan Cameron, because he died in 1967. The experiments were done in Canada, so the jury awards wouldn't be as big. And what happened then was the news was broken on a CBC news magazine-type program, and Linda McDonald, this is now almost 25 years after her treatment, quotation marks, treatment at McGill, she saw that on Canadian TV and realized that she'd been a victim of some kind of crazy experimentation, got herself a lawyer, and the lawyer ended up getting her $100,000 tax-free from the Canadian government in compensation. And also they set up a fund for all other survivors of those experiments, who they now automatically all get $100,000 each.
But how many of them were there? Do we have any idea?
The figure that's always said in public is 80 for that particular set of experiments.
But that was just one set of experiments.
So that's a drop in the bucket. Yeah.
You know, supposedly we're fighting communists. We're fighting the evil communists. But, you know, if we have this sort of people that's working at the highest echelons of our government, and they would do that to American citizens, well, what else would they do? We're going to explore a lot more about this. And I just want to just comment, there was a movie series recently called The Pretender, and it was about a young boy who was experimented on in this similar manner. And everybody thought, gee, that's a great, fun program, you know. The trouble is that when you talk to these people who've been in this program, that's exactly what happened. We'll be right back here with Dr. Colin Ross, and welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Colin Ross. We're talking about the experiments, these macabre experiments that were done. Now, nobody in our government has ever been held responsible for this, and they simply... But the thing is, it's not simply even the CIA. It was widely known by our doctors working in the medical schools who were getting these big fancy grants to carry on these macabre experiments. And they saw nothing morally wrong with them. And this is what happens when you have lost your concept of right and wrong, that there are absolutes, that there is a God, that we're answerable to a higher being for what we do. But if there is no God, what's really wrong with this sort of thing, especially if it gets you a grant and it gets you promotions? And so have you ever talked to anybody who has sort of commented on this story that was on television called The Pretender?
You mean a government official? Or
no, I'm just talking to the people. I've talked to several people who've been in these various mind-controlled units, and they say, the Pretender, I don't know whether you ever saw the program.
Yeah, I have seen it. Actually, the thing about The Pretender is it's a very mild version of reality.
A very mild.
What's in the documents is way... The declassified documents obviously are only the tip of the iceberg, but what's in the declassified documents is way more severe, destructive, and unethical than anything in The Pretender program.
Well, why don't you tell us really what they do? Because they've used children a lot, and you've even talked to these people, these children that, have been victims of these experiments. Why do they want children?
Well, you're starting to get out beyond the declassified documents now, but they do describe experimentation on children. And the Office of Naval Research funded a neurosurgeon at Yale, Jose Delgado, who published papers describing putting brain electrode implants in children as young as 11, and then using a remote transmitter box to stimulate those electrodes to control their behavior. He could get kids to sort of stare into space with a goofy expression on, fly into a rage, behave normally. That's all absolutely documented, funded by the military. There's a very revered child psychiatrist named Loretta Bender, and her funding sources are not stated in her papers, but she had kids, this is in the 60s at Creedmoor State Hospital in New York, she had kids age 5 to 10 on street-level doses of LSD and mescaline, LSD and psilocybin, for days, weeks, months, and in some cases years at a time.
Now, these were children in a hospital for mentally defective children? Or what?
Yeah, psychiatric disorders.
All right.
And which so would be mostly depression and attention deficit disorder, things like that.
So they use these children for medical experiments without their permission, without permission of their parents, just to see what's going to happen.
Right, based on really crazy, unscientific theories of how the brain works. And in the radiation experiments, the school was called, if I remember right, Fernald School for the Mentally Retarded, I think. It was in New England. And... they were putting radiation in cereal that these retarded kids were eating, and they directly told the parents that it was vitamins. So sometimes not only did they kind of tiptoe around the subject, they outright deliberately lied. One of the doctors who was involved in the brain electrode implant programs at Harvard was also involved in radiation experimentation. And in the report that Clinton commissioned, there's about a 900-and-something page advisory panel report, Clinton, they described this Dr. Sweet at Harvard injecting radioactive plutonium into a guy.
Well, we're going to have to interrupt you. We'll be right back here in just a moment. But... Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Dr. Colin Ross, is a practicing psychiatrist, and he works with dissociated personalities. These people who have had split personalities, and of course, the reason you have a split personality is because reality has become so horrible you can't face it. The trouble is that some of these dissociated personalities have been intentionally created by your tax dollars. By the CIA, and of course, they keep saying, oh, well, we did that in the past, but we'd never do that again. And if you believe that, you probably believe your Enron stock is going to come back again. But ladies and gentlemen, the tragedy is that at least we have the documentation, and Dr. Ross, in his book, Bluebird, has summarized the 15,000 pages of testimony he was able to get under the Freedom of Information Act, much of it redacted, because they don't want the public to know, but enough frightening and terrifying information there that, you know, if they would let this through, think of the things that they're not going to let you know about. And, of course, the criminal activity, these people, in my estimation, these physicians should be exposed for what they've done. But, of course, well, you're not going to read about this ordinarily in our major medical journals. So, and certainly not in most of our major news magazines or newspapers. So anyway, it's up to Dr. Ross, and he's done a great job. The book, Bluebird, Going into the Background of This Government Program, which became Artichoke, became MKUltra, became something else. Always changing the name, but never changing the diabolical nature of it. And Dr. Ross was telling us about some of the people that these macabre things have been done to. So would you want to pick up the story there?
Sure. It was this Dr. William Sweet, who was part of the brain electrode team at Harvard that was funded by the Navy. He also was involved in these radiation experiments, so he injected plutonium into this guy who arrived at an emergency department in Harvard.
Now, did the fellow know he was going to be given the plutonium?
Well, this is where it comes down to lying, because William Sweet testified that everybody gave informed consent, but this one guy arrived unconscious, his identity wasn't known, he was injected with plutonium experimentally, and he died without regaining consciousness. So it just goes on and on and on and on.
Well, dead men, that just goes to show you the truth of the fact that dead men tell no tales, and they can't even very well sue you for what you've done to them.
Right.
But of course, you know, and then you commented that they were feeding cereal laced with plutonium to the children at these state hospitals, you know, and telling the parents it was vitamins. And, of course, they knew that these were macabre experiments. And yet, of course, they did this. There were other experiments where they gave the children hepatitis, you know, just to see what would happen, various types of hepatitis. And there is nothing is ever done for the violation of people's rights. Of course, up in Canada, apparently, they at least had the decency to pay some of these people. And I know that there's one
I think that it was maybe partly out of decency, but it took a lot of pressure, and I think the Canadian government was really boxed into that by the limited hangout strategy of the CIA. They bucked it and fought it and resisted it and downplayed it and set up commissions to downplay it for quite a few years before anybody got compensation.
Well, here in the United States, we gave, I think, each one of the black men that we let to have the syphilis, and those that survived, you know, were not killed by the syphilis, we gave them $10,000.
Not at first.
No, I know, but eventually.
Eventually, yeah, there was a class action suit. But what they got, the study started in 42. At the 25-year mark of the study, they all got a certificate from the Surgeon General of the United States thanking them for participation, and a check for $25, $1 for each year of participation.
Right. Yeah, down the line, of course, when this whole, but, you know, of course, here, the victims of 9/11, why they're going to give them each $1 million, because that's with a promise that they won't sue the airlines or the Saudi Arabian or the Iraqi government for their involvement in that. But, you know, they weren't quite as generous a few years ago. But then, of course, then a dollar was worth a lot more than it is today.
Well, yeah, but it was $1 per year. I don't think the dollar was...
No. I was speaking eventually. I think they eventually did get 10,000, didn't they?
Actually, they got more than that. They got, I can't remember the total number of survivors and families at that point, but it was a 10 million class action settlement.
Right.
Yeah.
But by the time the lawyer got through with it, and they could have got a lot more, but I don't want to get into what the lawyer did, but, you know, he just sort of knuckled under, he got his fee, and there wasn't an awful lot left over for the people who were involved.
Right. The worst thing about that Tuskegee syphilis study was those guys had unprotected intercourse with a lot of women for 40 years, and it's absolutely 100% guaranteed that children were born with syphilis as a result of that experiment.
Well, there is an attitude among certain of our elite that just because they're black, you just don't treat them the same way as you do others. They don't want to admit that they're racist, but this is the ultimate in racism. And, of course, every one of the people is black. If everyone had been white, do you think this would have gone on?
A lot of the mind control experiments were on terminal cancer patients, sex offenders, drug addicts, prisoners, mental patients.
Right. Well, we're going to have to take our break here at the half hour, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and our guest this evening is Dr. Colin Ross, and we're talking about his book, Bluebird. And Dr. Ross actually deals with a lot of people with dissociative personalities, and many of them, of course, had come to him and had started telling him these stories. And as he listened to these stories, I think when he first heard this, that these people claimed they'd been victims of mind control, did you initially think they must have been just a little bit loony, that they all say that these were victims of a government mind control program?
Yeah, basically I thought they were probably delusional. Because I didn't have any knowledge of this.
Right? Well, the average individual wouldn't. And, no. You know, if somebody had walked into my office and told me that, and you know, I'd say, well, you know, obviously this is just crazy. You know, well, you need to see a psychiatrist, but you are the psychiatrist.
That's right. Well, the typical example you hear just in general in life, and you hear it from in psychiatry textbooks, and you hear it from your professors, is, now, you can tell somebody's insane for sure if they come and explain that they're a victim of CIA experiments or that the FBI is after them. Well, in 1970, I forget if it was 75 or 76, the General Counsel for the U.S. Army in Senate testimony released a list of 130 different compounds that the Army had tested in mind control experiments, which included LSD and BZ and many other different types of drugs. And they admitted at that time, they, the Army, to testing LSD on 1,500 different people. So, obviously, that's not all. That's the tip of the iceberg again. But if you take 1,500 people on LSD, and you multiply that by 130 different compounds, and you figure they didn't release the names of all the compounds, you're up in the hundreds of thousands of people who got at least one dose of LSD or some other drug in a mind control experiment. Now, only a minority of those people would have been recruited into really serious, complicated mind control programs. But the number of U.S. citizens who've been involved in at least one unethical mind control experiment is minimum in the hundreds of thousands in the second half of the 20th century.
Well, let's get a little bit into some of the other things that you've certainly been dealing with. Now, one of the things that I've heard from, and I've talked to four different people who've told me that they had personally met Dr. Mengele, and for our listeners who don't know who Mengele is, he was the worst of all the Nazi doctors. He was known as the Angel of Death. He was the one who used to experiment on the children in the concentration camps, and I've got books written about him. And then, of course, he mysteriously disappears, and he fled to South America. That's what happened to him, and this is what we're told. And yet I've talked to, at least myself, personally, four people who've told me independently, without ever prompting, that they knew Dr. Mengele. Now, and that met him sometimes many times. Have you ever encountered anybody who claims that they had met this Nazi butcher?
I have actually, a small number of people like you. And again, initially you'd think, oh yeah, right, that's too much, those people must be insane. But it's an absolute documented fact that Klaus Barbie, who was called the Butcher of Lyon, he was a big Nazi atrocity guy. He was hidden and protected by the CIA. That's an absolutely documented fact. So, and the CIA and the military did bring all these other Nazi criminals over to the United States. So it's not really far-fetched that Goebbels could have been taken out somewhere and protected.
Now, for our listener who thinks that this really is far-fetched, we have a book called The Gestapo Chief, and based on the memoirs of the head of the Gestapo. And you know where he went? He went to Berkeley in California. He traveled around America. He was brought here, given a fancy government job, eventually died in 83. And we even have another book called The Mueller Diaries. His name was Heinrich Mueller. He headed the German Gestapo. And we know how terrible and evil they were, so why did we bring the head of the German Gestapo over here and give him a nice job? Oh, well, he was going to help us fight the wicked communists. That's what it was all about. And, of course, ladies and gentlemen, you have to understand that there are people who have a different sense of morality than the average individual. We carry that book, incidentally. It's called Gestapo Chief, and, of course, he correlated to that are the Mueller Diaries, and they're hard to get. Of course, the one thing is they don't want the American people to know that, why we might sort of get an idea that there were some wicked people in government, and certainly we wouldn't want the American people to get the wrong idea. So, you know, of course, as you deal with these people, can you help them? Can you help them to overcome these problems, these split personalities, as we refer to them as?
Well, the people that I work with clinically, they've basically developed 2, 3, 5, 10, 15 different characters inside it's kind of divide and conquer strategy. There's just too much pain, too much terror, too much trauma, I mean, sadness, loneliness.
They have maybe 10 or 15 different personalities.
Yeah. And there's really no limit to it. You can create a whole kind of like Lord of the Rings internal fantasy world in your mind if you want and have really no limit to the number of characters. But the number of identities that actually come out, take control of your body and do stuff is fairly limited just because there's not enough room in your life. But basically the thing about this disorder is not that it's fascinating or bizarre or interesting, but that it's very treatable. These people, not all of them, and nobody can cure all of anything in psychiatry, but these people, if they work real hard in therapy and they stick with it and they deal with all the pain and learn more healthy coping strategies, they can be integrated back into one person, and their anxiety symptoms, their depression, their substance abuse, all their other types of addictions, self-mutilation, depression, all of that settles down. It's amazing to see the level of recovery that's possible.
Well, now, have you run into any of these people who claim that they're victims of satanic ritual abuse?
Yeah, I actually wrote a book published in 95 called Satanic Ritual Abuse, Principles of Treatment, because hundreds of people like that were coming through my program, and there's all this controversy, is it real, not real, real memories, false memories, is it coming from reality or coming from the therapist's imagination? So I read the existing literature on that, which is really small, and wrote a book. Basic idea of the book was, here's how you do therapy so that what you're doing and your strategies don't depend on whether the memories are real or not.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, do you believe that there is such a thing as satanic ritual abuse?
Well, that's kind of a funny question.
Well, it's not a funny question. I think it's a very legitimate question.
It's not amusing, but it's... Well, I'll explain what I mean by it's a funny question. It depends what you call satanic. If you call a very organized, widespread human sacrifice cult that's driven by a warped theology satanic, then we've got two examples. The Catholic Inquisition, which tortured and burned a minimum of hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of witches, in a very systematic, organized way based on a theology. The second example that we know is the Third Reich. Those guys were driven by this sort of bizarre Aryan supremacy, sort of Teutonic mythology set of beliefs. A lot of those leading Nazis thought that they were incarnations of great leaders from hundreds of years ago, and they practiced some elements of Satanism, and they had a lot of rituals and symbols, and they obviously sacrificed a lot of people.
But
so this is just the way human beings behave.
Some people are very evil.
Yeah. Now, do we have objective evidence that human sacrifice has been widely practiced in North America? No. But there's nothing about it that's beyond what we know of serial killers, Nazis, and the Inquisition.
All right. So, but some of your people do come in and complain of that they are victims of satanic ritual abuse.
Oh yeah, lots. Yeah.
All right. Now, of course, then we get into something. Of course, it's the false memory syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And the false memory syndrome, I'd never even heard of it till I got started doing talk radio back in 1994. And a family called, and they said that their family had become the victims of local psychologists planting ideas in their daughter's memory. And, of course, they'd been accused and they had been sued for, being part of some sort of a satanic cult. I've forgotten the exact details of the story, but under any circumstances, they had been victimized by this false memory. And so then we saw the videos put out by the False Memory Association, and there were, of course, they have meetings and they have all these psychiatrists, and they talk about how all these ideas of satanic ritual abuse are all false memories implanted by psychologists, and perhaps some of them are. But one of the things you pointed out in your book was that, isn't it interesting that many of these psychiatrists who talk about the false memory are exactly the same psychiatrists who are paid by the CIA, and you have the document, to do all these macabre things that you've described?
Yeah, and that's no coincidence. I'm absolutely convinced that's part of a disinformation program and everybody covering their own butts in academia. So two of the guys who are, the organization is called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation. It's got a professional and scientific advisory board. And that's really the group of people who spearheaded the attack in psychiatry on the validity of multiple personality disorder. They're saying it's just a bogus diagnosis and have been spearheading, it's all false memories. And so it turns out that two of the guys on the professional advisory board, both of whom died in the last few years, Martin Orne and Jolly West, were CIA MKUltra contractors with top secret clearance, and their own personal projects had to do with hypnosis, dissociation, multiple personality, and the Manchurian Candidate programs.
All right, and I think that, so what you're basically saying is that the false memory syndrome movement was an effort to cover, the things that were done. Now, do you think that there actually have been some psychologists and their enthusiasm have implanted false memories in people?
Definitely. Oh, yeah, I've testified in court cases that this is an example of a way out of control therapy that's implanted false memories of satanic ritual abuse and other kinds of false memories. And I don't think the False Memory Syndrome Foundation is just one thing. I think it's a group of different interests. One is a whole bunch of parents who, in fact, were falsely accused of things they didn't do. And then there's another group that's a bunch of basically memory researchers who are all interested in how memory works. And then there's probably a group of people who are just kind of ugly people. And then there's a group who are the Manchurian Candidate contractors, their colleagues, their friends. And they've kind of co-opted the false memory movement, try and discredit multiple personality and cover up the Manchurian Candidate programs.
All right. Now, I think that the Manchurian Candidate program is one of the most important things I learned from your book. And, of course, for the listener out there who doesn't remember, the Manchurian Candidate, based upon a story, a movie, it was a book and then it was a movie. And, of course, that whole idea, these American POWs have been captured by the Koreans. They've been sent back here. But, of course, they had been brainwashed in the meantime. And one of them was a Manchurian Candidate. His job, I think, was to assassinate the president, something like that.
And a presidential candidate.
Right, of course. And Angela Lansbury played the villain. And, of course, she would trigger the Manchurian Candidate by turning over the Queen of Hearts, Queen of Diamonds, I've forgotten, Queen of Diamonds it was.
Right.
So basically, then we're told, well, gee, because the wicked communists had been working on the creating Manchurian candidates, we had to do all these experiments so we would understand how to counter that sort of thing and recognize Manchurian candidates, and perhaps POWs who had been brainwashed and hypnotized and could be triggered. And so, a lot of people would say, well, gee, the communists are doing this. Why, we've got to do these things to counter them. What's the counter to that remark or that premise?
There's three counters to that premise. Number one, a psychologist named G.H. Esterbrooks, I've got a lot of documents to back this up, including his own writings. The psychologist G.H. Esterbrooks was creating Manchurian candidates for operational use by the War Department during the Second World War. So that's point number one.
Now, long before the Korean War.
Way before. Yeah. And Bluebird, the first in a series of mind control programs, was signed into existence by the director of the CIA in April 1950, and the Korean War didn't start until June 1950. And the first book on Korean brainwashing, Communist Chinese brainwashing, was written by a CIA officer named Edward Hunter. And he describes in his book that the level of brainwashing used by the Communist Chinese was a mild version of a much more sinister and complicated type of brainwashing. And the only way he could have known that is from U.S. programs.
All right, Sven, I actually have Edward Hunter's book. I didn't realize he was a CIA operative at the time, and I still have several copies of it. So it's these are the sort of things that I learned from that, talking to my guests, that I read Hunter's book many years ago on brainwashing. And it certainly told about how with sleep deprivation and with this constant pressure on these people, you could get these young men just to totally break down.
And he actually had two terms. The whole book he mentions brainwashing all the time, but the more sinister, more complicated level, he called that brain cleansing.
Right.
Which is what happened to Linda McDonald. Her brain was cleansed of 26 years of memories.
Right, and of course, this is what your tax dollars were done used for here. And it's so difficult for the average American to believe that we, who are supposedly based upon a moral, a philosophy, that officials in our government would do something that evil.
And I know you're focused on the government. I don't want to lose the focus on the medical profession, the psychiatrists, and the universities, because they're equally in this. All these programs could not be run without doctors cooperating and running them.
And you're so right. And, Chris, the real problem is the fact that we've lost a moral foundation, a sense of right and wrong, and the dignity of the human, and trained in medicine. You're to respect individuals. You're to respect their rights. You go into medicine to help people.
You go into medicine to help people, but you're soon taught that human beings are biological machines. That's the basic philosophy
that
dominates biological psychiatry today.
Well, and of course, the thing is that we do not teach the morality to our young doctors today. I still try to keep up with what goes on in my medical community. And, there's no longer that wonderful spirit of medicine that was there when I was there and practiced for 40 years. This idealism, it seems to be, it just isn't there. And what they've done is they've destroyed medicine. It's no longer a profession. It's a business. And people are so busy looking over their shoulder and filling out government paperwork and worried about the government coming in and stealing everything they've ever had because they filled out a form wrong, and they can charge you with all these things and force you to confess to something you haven't done. And so we've really destroyed, but part of it is the medical school training, and then part of it is society itself that has repudiated these concepts of right and wrong, and everything is relative. We've got Mike calling in here. Hi, Mike. Did you have a question or comment?
Yeah, a couple things. Speaking of Harvard, I wonder if your guest knows anything about Richard Alpert.
Richard Alpert.
I believe that's where he
was one of the early LSD guys who was a buddy of Leary's, right?
Yeah, and if my memory served me correctly, he was a professor at Harvard.
Right. Did you have any questions at all?
I just wondered if your guest knew anything about him.
The LSD experimentation was developed and funded by the CIA and the Army, so all those guys who were early LSD researchers were either directly or indirectly funded by the CIA and the military.
Mm-hmm.
The first major supplier of LSD in North America was Eli Lilly Company, the manufacturer of Prozac. They got a top secret MKUltra grant in 1953 for $400,000 to manufacture and supply LSD. So all of that Harvard LSD would have been CIA LSD.
And of course, the other thing is, of course, they are also the ones that made the thimerosal, the mercury that has damaged so many children's brains. Anything else, Mike?
Yeah, one more. Ken Kesey began his work, which led, of course, to the electric Kool-Aid acid tests in the mid-60s. He was...
Berg and a number of those other guys were turned on to LSD in LSD experiments run by psychiatrists funded by the CIA and the military, documented.
Mike, we're going to have to let you go. You're going to have to call another line because we got a terrible hum there, okay?
Okay.
Bye-bye. You can call back if you want to, but that was just a bad line. Anyway, of course, I remember Ken Kesey, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and, of course, this whole idea of, using lobotomy. Now, did the CIA finance the studies in lobotomy, too?
In the Bluebird documents, there's a paragraph on one page called The Problem of Disposal of Subjects. And there's a discussion there about using lobotomy to dispose of mind control subjects.
In other words, so that they would not be able to respond, or they would not be able to tell people their affect, their memory, everything would be destroyed?
Right. Exactly. One of the authors of The Three Faces of Eve, famous book on multiple personality,
right.
He described doing 200 lobotomies in a Georgia prison in one day. And he's got ties to a whole variety of MKUltra mind control contractors.
Well, now, why would they do something like that? Would they do that simply because they wanted to change the hostility of the patients, or they just do it to see what would happen?
It's a mixture of all of the above. There's this kind of distorted, misguided, pseudoscientific idea that we're doing treatment. There's a sort of ghoulish, monstrous, mad scientist element to it. And then there's the CIA contractor side of it, all kind of mixed together.
Now, why would the CIA be so interested in lobotomies, doing lobotomies on people?
Well, it's just a way to neutralize somebody so they don't talk and tell. They describe, in the Bluebird and Artichoke documents, they describe people who've been used as assets, who are being held in prisons, who are being given basically a mixture of hypnosis, sensory deprivation, sodium malitol, alcohol, and barbiturates to erase their memories and implant false memories. That's very clearly described in the documents.
And they would actually then, they would actually intentionally create false memories in people of events that never happened.
Right.
Would you like to sort of describe the Manchurian candidate? Because you talked about, you know, how they would use, say, an officer or something as
sure.
a courier. How does that work?
Well, the Manchurian candidate is described, the actual sort of plot of the Manchurian candidate movie is described exactly in Bluebird and Artichoke documents that came out half a decade before the movie. And in these other documents going back to War Department contracts in the Second World War. They don't go into a lot of detail on the actual techniques, but basically they take the susceptible subject, which means somebody who's probably a good hypnotic subject, and I believe somebody who has prior trauma, a lot of serious childhood trauma, who's already fragmented and dissociated internally. Then they use a variety of techniques that are in all the documents. That's hallucinogenic drugs, sensory deprivation, hypnosis, interrogation techniques, and so on. And they create a new identity. It's hidden behind an amnesia barrier. And then there's post-hypnotic signals to access the personality. So you'll call somebody into your office, and Esterbrooks used the phrase, the moon is clear. That would flip the person to his new identity. You then give him a classified piece of information, flip him back to his normal identity, send him on some benign trip to wherever. At the far end, another handler says the moon is clear, flips him to his new identity, he passes on the classified information. And then more a response is inserted, process is done in reverse. And these kind of people were used for courier and infiltration assignments, and in the Manchurian Candidate movie for assassination. The basic idea is they can be planted as sleepers for year indefinitely. They can be activated with hypnotic signals. And if they're captured and interrogated, they genuinely have amnesia for the whole operation and can't spill the beans.
Well, now, of course, I was always taught when I was in medical school, well, you can't hypnotize anybody and get them to do anything they wouldn't do. You can't hypnotize people and get them to commit a crime. Is that true?
Well, to me, that's both a dumb question and actually a kind of disinformation strategy.
Well, looking back on it, I think it probably was. And I think even as
well, I say that for a very simple reason. You can take any ordinary citizen, put him through boot camp, and turn him into a killer.
Right.
It's not a hard thing to do. It's very easy. And so if you you add on to that really serious sensory deprivation and isolation, all kinds of drugs, hypnosis, physical spinning, induction of nausea, that's not the least bit difficult to imagine to me.
All right, fine. And so... I think it's very difficult for a lot of our listeners to imagine that this sort of thing goes on in America. The tragedy is it does go on. And the fact that people don't know that is simply a reflection of the degree of control that today exists over what the American people think. Well, are there any other major points that we haven't touched on this hour?
Well, I think I'd like to mention non-lethal weapons. That's a whole set of different energy beams, electromagnetic radiation of various kinds, sound, infrasound, and so on. There's a whole program of weapons like that that have been described in detail in U.S. News and World Report, and they go all the way back to the primitive precursors that were developed in MKUltra. And these weapons, I would say for sure, have been tested on unwitting civilians up to the present. And they either knock you out, make you sick, disable you, alter your state of consciousness or your behavior.
Well,
that, again, there's got to be doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists involved in all of that. And again, it's absolutely against all medical ethics.
Well, you know, we hear about some of these weapons that will make ideas come into your mind. Is there really something that will actually do that, in the way of a beam or so that you'll actually hear something in your head?
Well, for sure, just a general buzzing or noise, being disoriented, being confused, or knocking you out. That's all documented, that's for sure. How fancy the technology is and whether you can monkey around with somebody at the level of specific thoughts, I don't know.
Well, we keep hearing these things, and of course, after talking to you for on several occasions, why some of the unthinkable seems to be, very real, and, well, we'll just have to wait and see. Anyway, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I think that the profession of medicine and psychiatry in particular really needs to be judged in public and needs to pay some consequences for all this and needs to come clean on it.
I agree with you totally. Thank you so much. Our guest has been Dr. Colin Ross. His book, Bluebird, if you'd like to know anything more about that, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that was Dr. Colin Ross. I hope you enjoyed the program. Usually we can evaluate how people feel by whether we're getting calls. And, of course, Mike's always a regular caller, but we know we have many listeners all over the Northwest. And I hope you enjoyed the program, and that's why you didn't call. Because this is information you must understand. And the book goes into, of course, to Saran, the man who killed Bobby Kennedy. There's so much more in the book that we really just couldn't cover in 1 hour. But there are so many examples of thought control. What's the truth about the man who killed John Lennon? Was he a Manchurian candidate of some sort? And Dr. Ross addresses this and many, many other issues in his book, Bluebird. I recommend it because you have to understand what's gone on in the past to really understand what's taking place today. Well, this is the time when I certainly want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and now more than ever before. We need your help to extend our coverage out across America with the news behind the news, the story behind the story, the information you're not going to get from other sources. So if you agree there's a problem and you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family and help us as we reach out 5 hours every day on radio and shortwave, internet, satellite, on our weekend program that goes to 35 stations. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, we hope that you will definitely consider joining the Radio Liberty family. If not, perhaps just taking our newsletter. If you'd like a free copy of the newsletter, we'll be glad to send you one. Just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. And then please go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, and you can listen to our programs there on the Internet. You can pull down our newsletters, the other things we've written. But please tell others about our programs. Tell them about our Internet site. Encourage them to listen. A lot of people don't want to hear the truth today, but your job is to tell them. As we're told in Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33, that we are to be the watchmen. We're to be the watchman on the wall, trying to awaken people as to the truth of what's going on. And you're the one who has to be responsible. And if you don't tell people, of course, their blood is on your hands. If they ignore what you say, why, their blood is on their hands. Because we're involved in a spiritual battle for the survival of Western civilization, for the survival of Christian civilization. We're moving rapidly towards a new world order, a new world religion. We're moving rapidly towards World War III. We're moving rapidly towards the loss of freedom at home here in response to the terrorist threat. Well, we just simply ask you to pray for America, to pray for our boys going into battle, to pray for the civilians, to pray the war will be over quickly and with as little loss as possible, to pray for our leaders and our ministers, to pray for revival. And then, of course, please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, my ministry, for our provision and protection. And remember, in times like this, the words of our Lord, "Lo, I will be with you always, even unto the end of the world." And that is what keeps me going. Until tomorrow, at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we'd hoped to have Dr. Ross with us for 2 hours this evening, and he could only stay for 1 hour. So I thought, especially considering the significance of the events of last night and today, why we'd just have open lines and would let you call in and have your expression on your feelings about what's going on. How do you feel about the demonstrators up in San Francisco who were blocking the streets today and dragging the newspaper stands out in the middle of the street and keeping people from going to work and just doing everything to annoy people demonstrating against the war? Do you think that's an effective thing to do? How do you feel about people who are threatening to close down our society? How do you think about the people who are down there picketing the Marine recruiting of the Army or Navy recruiting stations here in Santa Cruz and across the nation? What should we be doing at this time? Certainly, we're moving into war. There's nothing that you or I or anybody else is going to do. Whether we agree with the war is not important. What should we be doing now? What are you feeling about the demonstrators? And I'd like to get your thoughts. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And you know, of course, my view of this, I look back on the Vietnam War. And of course, I was a victim of government propaganda at the time. And I supported the Vietnam War. And of course, we had a lot of the demonstrators. We had massive demonstrations at that time against the war. But I wasn't smart enough at that time to realize that all of these demonstrations were being backed by the same people. In other words, there's a book I think was called The Strawberry Connection. The Strawberry, that's not exactly it, but it was actually written by a fellow from the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, and he was talking about how, you know, at the SDS meetings there were people from Exxon, another oil company, they're recruiting the radicals because they wanted them out demonstrating so that they, of course, the radicals would really look bad, and that would make the people from the great oil companies who were pushing many of the same programs, but they wouldn't look quite so radical. And, of course, it was very obvious, I think, to many of the people within the demonstrations eventually that the whole thing was simply a setup. What the people do not understand is that communism, from its very inception, has been financed by the same capitalists that many of the so-called communists oppose. In fact, there was a woman named Dobbs, and she was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. And she was a lawyer, very intelligent woman. And the problem was that, you know, she was totally dedicated to the Communist Party, as most communists. She was willing to give not only 10% of everything she made, but most of her time to this cause of overthrowing the wicked capitalist nation. And then, of course, one day, it was during the Second World War, and she, communist was over here, they were getting ready to go back to Russia, the war was on, and of course we were allies with the communists, but the people in the Central Committee of the Communist Party were afraid that they would lose contact with Russia, and so she went to this high-ranking official and said, look, if we lose contact with you, how will we know the official party line in Moscow so we can continue to support you? And, oh, the man said, you just go over there, Waldorf Astoria. And she gave the names of three different men there at the Waldorf Astoria, and he said, any one of them could give you the official Communist Party line. Well, these were three of the most wealthy capitalists in the United States. And at that time, she suddenly realized everything was a put-on. That it was all financed by exactly the same people. Here were these capitalists who could give her the official Communist Party line from Russia. Well, had she gone back and read many of the books that were written shortly after the Russian Revolution, for instance, a book we have in our library by a man named Bruce Lockhart, who was sent to Russia after the Russian Revolution by Lloyd Milner, who was the head of the War Cabinet under Lloyd George in the years following the Russian Revolution. If you actually read the book Tsarism and Revolution, which we have a copy of, it was written by a Russian general, and of course everybody in Russia at the time of the Russian Revolution believed it had been brought about by Sir George Buchanan, the British ambassador to Russia, and by Lord Milner, who at that time was on the War Cabinet, on the War Cabinet, and Lord George's party, Lord George's government. Lord George took over in 1916, and they kept the war going for another senseless 2 years. What, of course, everybody did not know was that Lord Milner was one of the four original members of Cecil Rhodes' secret society. And when you understand the secret society, then all these stories take on a much different a context. But of course, according to the book Tsarism and Revolution, everybody believed at that time that Lord Milner had been passing out money, encouraging the Russian Revolution. We know he was in Russia immediately prior to the Russian Revolution, the March Revolution. If you read Sir George Buchanan's diary or memoirs, we have those, he spends 16 pages claiming how absurd it is that everybody would think that he and Lord Milner had created the revolution. Well, geez, methinks thou protest too loudly. But you have to understand that there was a very close relationship between Lord Milner and the communists. And this is exemplified in the book, A British Agent, by Bruce Lockhart. After the revolution, of course, Great Britain withdrew Sir George Buchanan, the English ambassador, and Lord Milner sent Bruce Lockhart over to Russia as their representative. And in the book, Lockhart obviously is not an insider. He's a nice, idealistic young man. And what really bothered him so much, he just couldn't understand why Lenin was so obsequious to him as a representative of Lord Milner, and, of course, so obsequious to another man named Thompson, I believe, who represented the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, a man named Robbins in New York. And Robbins was a member of the Federal Reserve Bank, and he was also dedicated to communism. And his representative was a man named Thompson there in Moscow. And so Lenin, whenever they would have a meeting of the Comintern, of the Central Committee of the Communist Party, would invite Lockhart and Thompson to attend the meetings. And then they'd always ask him what they thought. And at one point in the book, why Lockhart says he really was amazed that Thompson was furious one day and told him to come over to his apartment. He was getting ready to leave Moscow, and it turned out that one of Lenin's close associates had insulted. He was a communist leader of the Communist Party, had insulted Thompson. And Thompson had said, either you get rid of that man or I'm leaving Moscow tomorrow. And Thompson had said, well, all right, I'll get rid of the man. I'll send him to Bern. And Thompson said, well, since I can't send him to hell, the best thing we can do is have him burn. And there was sort of a takeoff on Bern, Switzerland, and burning in hell. But you read this book and you say, why would Lenin be so obsequious to the representatives of the wicked capitalists, until you begin to understand that it's all a scam? And you go to the headquarters of the Council on Foreign Relations at 68th Street in New York City, as I have on a number of occasions, and I've spent many weeks there going through the papers. And there you will find, right next to the secretary's desk, this big, beautiful mahogany desk, and you have to go sign in there every time you come in. And there, of course, in the book, you look, and there will be the people from the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation and people from all the various think tanks there. They're all doing research. And, of course, I'm there doing research, going through the history, trying to understand how these people think. And because you have to understand that they control our government. They control both political parties, and whether Secretary of State Colin Powell or his predecessor Madeleine Albright, or you go back to all the Secretaries of State, and almost, I think, every one of them, above one, that was Jimmy Baker, going back to 1953, every single Secretary of State has been a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and James Baker III became a member of the CFR after he quit being Secretary of State. So this is how it all ties together. It really doesn't matter whether Republicans or Democrats from the White House. No, they all come from the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Council on Foreign Relations is a front for the secret society that Lord Milner and Cecil Rhodes created back in 1891. And of course, if you go through their papers, first of all, at the Council on Foreign Relations, you will find that they have had almost every leading communist since the time of Lenin, other than Stalin, come back and talk to them and give them addresses, come to, because the communists come to New York to talk to members of the Council on Foreign Relations. But I started to tell you that there next to this big mahogany desk there in the foyer to the library where I'd have to sign in, next to that is this little stand, and there's, of course, it's a mahogany stand, and it's obviously very, very old. It's got glass on the top and then a neon light underneath, and there is this picture, pardon me, this copy of Foreign Affairs Magazine, 1921 and 1922. 1922 probably, or 23. And of course, this is a very treasured possession of the Council on Foreign Relations, because Lenin, this mass murderer, this most vicious of vile of human beings, had read their edition of Foreign Affairs Magazine. And you have to understand that the goal of communism is ruling elite and the enslavement of the people, and the goal of the Council on Foreign Relations is a ruling elite and the oppression of the people, enslavement of the people. They're all working for the same goal, this one world society. But you have to have, of course, the two forces opposing one another, and that's a Hegelian concept. You have a thesis and antithesis. Two opposing forces are struggling, and then, of course, the synthesis will be the New World Order, the New World Religion. And, of course, if you read the books by Professor Sutton, Anthony Sutton, you will find that, it was Ford Motor Company, the Armand Hammer, Avo Harriman, the Morgan Bank, Exxon, the Standard Oil, Rockefellers, they all financed the communist movement from its very inception. It never could have existed without constant infusions of technology and money from the United States, any more than the North Vietnamese could have kept a war going for 10 years against the United States during the Vietnam War without constant infusions of help to Russia, through Russia, from the United States to keep the war going. And so you had to have the enemy to maintain the war. And this was exactly what happened, with Russia. Russia never could have existed without help from the United States. And certainly in the excellent book, it's a trilogy published by Hoover Institute. Last time I checked, it was still in print, called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, three volumes by Professor Sutton, going into how we financed the Soviet Union from its inception. But you see, we can't let the American people know that, because they've got to believe we've got these two forces fighting one another. We've got the wicked communists on one side and of course, the altruistic people on our side. And of course, but this has always been the lie. And, of course, we get into the demonstrations, the peace demonstrations during the Vietnam War. Of course, they were funded by the communists, but who was funding the communists during the Vietnam War? Why, the United States. Massive loans to the communists, massive loans which we eventually wrote off to them. It was during the Vietnam War when the communists were financing and coordinating the demonstrations here in the United States, that we built the Kama River plant in Russia. We just built it for them for nothing, the largest truck manufacturing company and a plant in the entire world. I think it was 36 acres, something like that. And those trucks were then shipped to Vietnam to haul the supplies down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. The supplies were used to kill American boys. And then, of course, we had the Ford Motor Plant. And the Ford Motor Plant was updated during that time and built the trucks that went down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. And then, of course, we financed the Fiat Motor Company. Fiat built this massive plant to build cars in Russia, but we put up the money for it. And, of course, we gave Russia the technology for their sophisticated radar and for their weapons, and then they transferred them to the North Vietnamese. And, of course, we financed the Russians who financed the North Vietnamese so we could keep the war going all that time. But here in the United States, we had to have the anti-war demonstrations. And, of course, they were funded by the great foundations. They were funded by the communists. They're coordinated by the communists. But the communist movement has always been funded under the auspices of our own government, the best enemy that money could buy. So you had the thesis, you had the antithesis. If you get in the background of the demonstrations up in Seattle, and we have a four-tape set called The Battle of Seattle, who funded the perpetrators, the organizers of this. There were a number of men there in ninja suits. There were black suits, black face masks. Who funded them? Well, they came out of an organization called Ruckus. And who funded Ruckus? Our foundations, the Ted Turners of this world, tied into Earth First, this whole movement against the World Trade Organization meetings was funded by the people who were supporting the World Trade Organization meetings. And the people were just too stupid, too confused to understand. Because what did the demonstrators want? Why, they wanted, of course, the World Trade Organization to stress environmental controls in third world countries, and, of course, the labor rights and better rights and higher wages for labor, which is, of course, typical communist goals, and the same thing that the great corporations were actually pushing at the same time they were supposedly opposing. And, of course, the average individual finds it difficult to understand why, on one hand, you oppose, on the other hand, you support. And it's all the dialectics, two opposing forces fighting one another, the thesis, the antithesis, resulting in a synthesis. So I'd like to know your thoughts about the demonstrations we've seen. How do you feel about them at this stage? Should we be supporting the demonstrations? Should we be opposing the demonstrations? At this point in the history of our nation, as our boys are moving into battle, what should be going on? And, of course, I will ask you out across America to give us a call. Our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. And I know many people in this community feel very strongly about the war, but I'd like to know what you feel should be done now. Nathan, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, good night, Doc. Good evening.
Good evening, okay. I thought you were saying goodbye.
Yeah, well, it's been a long day.
I bet it has. Well, it's been a long day for all of us, and I know that you, so many of our listeners out there, feel very strongly about what happened last night and today.
Well, listen, my basic opinion is that these people are misreading Thoreau. They're misreading the way that Martin Luther King and the 60s demonstrators behaved. I don't think that taking a defecation or vomiting on the street is really the way to go about this. It's not dignified. You know, you have to choose. Are you going to do insurrection, or are you going to do civil disobedience? They seem to want to have something in the middle. And I don't think there's anything in the middle. Both are legitimate at times. I believe civil disobedience is legitimate, you know, in this instance for those who oppose the war. But clearly there's been a breakdown. I'm sorry, but I just can't shake the feeling that among the idealistic demonstrators are the enemies of the country. People who, whether they're pro-communist or pro-Islamicist or maybe pro this agenda behind the scenes, agent provocateurs, I don't know. And I don't really care, because it actually doesn't really matter to me. I have to look at how people behave. And I live near San Francisco, as you know. And it does affect our lives here. It affects our sense of safety. And, there are real... It has an effect on people's daily lives. And frankly, I don't think that the cause of Saddam Hussein is worth it. I know in the Vietnam era, you had a very complicated issue, because some people believed that, wrongly, but some people believed that Ho Chi Minh represented some sort of popular revolution or some sort of popular progressive movement. I think that they were deceived. But in this case, clearly everybody in the world, including the Muslims, everybody can see that Saddam Hussein is simply a vicious tyrant. And, I don't understand why they don't put their efforts into something like world hunger. The IMF, I agreed with that. That was a different case, but that I can see blocking traffic for. The WTO, I can see blocking traffic for. The Vietnam War, I can probably see something, maybe. But in this particular instance, civil rights, I can definitely see blocking traffic for. The American Revolution, yeah, I would support that cause too. But this particular cause, I just, maybe someone can explain it to me. I just don't understand it. I really don't.
All right. Well, of course, do you think that people have a right to demonstrate as they're demonstrating?
I think that the right is contingent. I think rights in this case are circumstantial. In other words, what is the circumstance? how just is the cause. There are some instances where you have the Boston Tea Party model or the Martin Luther King going into businesses and occupying the model, or the standing in front of the Berlin Wall model. And to tell you the truth, I felt that the Gulf War I, 1991, was a lot more morally, the protests were a lot more morally legitimate because we were effectively moving to reimpose a dictator onto Kuwait, to liberate them from one dictator and reimposing another one.
Right.
And I, frankly, that seemed to be a lot more about oil. The so-called world community, these hip, self-righteous hypocrites like France and these other nations, were obviously on board because they wanted their lousy oil. The Bush administration, of course, was on board, and that, I'm sure, had a lot to do with oil and other agendas, but New World Order and all the rest of it. But, you know, I'm not even looking at that right now. I'm looking at the behavior of these people, and I just don't understand how it is that this particular cause is worth it. And by the way, don't say, I'm not necessarily saying I'm pro-war. I've been trying to clarify my position on this because, actually, my views on it are very complicated. They're very nuanced, and they, you know, it would take a long time to get into, and we don't have the full 2 hours to have me on again, and you probably would be bored to tears. But the fact of the matter is, Dr. Stan, that I don't think there's any controversy here. This is not Thoreau or civil disobedience in a mature sense.
Well, of course, there's one thing, you know, to demonstrate. The Constitution gives us the right to demonstrate and redress of our grievances. But here they're actually just trying to, they're not simply demonstrating, they're actually disrupting. They're just stopping people from getting to work. They're trying to, close down the function of government and society. And of course, one of the things, if you carry this forward and this persists for a period of time, it could begin, of course, to almost get to the point where you would have massive demonstrations. You might have to bring in the military. You might actually have to have a military dictatorship temporarily, or only temporarily, of course, you understand, to put down this uprising. Do you think that might be something that people who hate America might actually want?
I mentioned the concept before of agent provocateurs as a possibility, but, you know, I'm not even really even looking at that, you know, whether they're the Islamicists or agent provocateurs or some other agenda. You know, I actually don't care about that so much because I know most people out there aren't. Most people out there are just stupid. And you know, it's to those people that I'm sort of directing this, is that they should know better. I expect people who are conspirators. I mean, the Founding Fathers warned of conspiracies. Cicero warned of conspiracies. You know, I expect they're going to be out there. If they weren't, there'd be something wrong because, you know, God didn't mean for this world to be a paradise. He meant for it to be a testing ground. But, you know, my main point here is actually, you know, and I also don't want to be mistaken for necessarily being pro-war, because there is the issue of Congress should be declaring wars and not the president. And there's a definite constitutional issue here of the balance of power. And there are definitely a lot of problems that I have with this. But, you know, your friends last night were making a good point about this concept that kings were used, including warrior kings, were used in the Bible, or the Old Testament, as you call it, to execute justice. And definitely the tyranny of Babylon was leveled by the other warring monarchy of King Cyrus of Persia, the Medo-Persia. So, you know, I think that the notion that nothing good, that the freedom of the Iraqi people won't come of this, it shouldn't be taken into account, that we just simply look at these political abstractions that the anti-war side looks at. I just don't understand.
Well, let me just put you down. I assume that right now you're against this the anti-war demonstrations at this time, and certainly the way they're being carried out.
Yes.
Would that be a fair statement to make?
Yes, I am.
So I'm going to mark you down in that category.
Mark me down as not understanding why this issue is the issue. I can definitely understand a lot of other issues that they could be upset about, but this particular issue No. And that's not necessarily from someone who supports George Bush.
All right, fine. Maybe all the world's a stage and all the men and women simply actors upon it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Janice calling in. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. This is Open Lines, and we'd like to get your thoughts about what we're talking about. Go ahead there. Janice, hi. Good. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, Dr. Stan.
You haven't called me, I think, in a couple of years. It's good to hear from you.
It's been a while, but we listen.
All right.
And, I have a comment on the protesting.
Fine. Are you for or against the protests, and why?
Well, I heard an interesting comment. I'll just say this first. On the radio, it was a comment someone was making on the protesting going on in San Francisco this morning. And it was obviously a person of a Hispanic background. And he said, you know, in America, you're for peace, right? This is what you're for, peace. But what is this? You know, and it was like, I can't get to work. That's not really peace to me, you know. And it just struck me as being very profound, because it's kind of a contradiction, you know, for people to think that they're creating some kind of a peaceful effort, and really what they're doing is causing a lot of headaches, problems, and interference of normal life that people need to do. And I don't think that's right. I really don't. I don't think that's the point. And the other problem I have with demonstrators is that something I was talking about with my husband earlier is that my opinion is that a good percentage of these people are coming out of our universities and colleges, and they're taught by their their professors that this is the democratic way. You know, we need to get out there and protest. This is what we do in this country. And I'm thinking, okay, but that doesn't really change things. You know, if our teachers and the colleges were really concerned about making, you know, their students learn how to really get in there and change things, then they would be encouraging them to learn as much as they can learn, and to be smart, and to be able to go into the system as it is, you know, as a legal system that we have, and change it from within that, you know, that system.
Well, Janice, the thing that worries me is that they do get a lot of these young people, idealistic people, into the government.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, what government do they want? They want to establish here in this country exactly what George Bush says he wants to establish over in Iraq. They want to establish a democracy.
Yeah.
Now, the history of democracies, as you well know, is they always present, eventually become despotisms. Plato noticed it. Certainly the people in ancient Rome knew it. Our founding fathers knew it. In fact, as you've heard me say so many times before, James Madison, writing in the 10th of the Federalist Papers, talking about how democracies are rare spectacles of turbulence and contention, are incompatible with personal rights of private property and personal liberty, and are usually as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. And there is no mention in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, the Federalist Papers, ever of a democracy, other than to say the last thing we want in America is a democracy, and that's why every one of our states is a republic. So, but our young people believe in democracy, and George Bush believes in democracy. And all I can say is, I'm embarrassed when a president of the United States gets up and says, we want to bring democracy to the Middle East and to Iraq. I would think he would want to bring freedom, and he certainly would want to restrict the power of government and give the people the opportunity to be free, because freedom, liberty, and limited government are synonymous. Democracy, the majority rules. Democracy is two wolves negotiating with a sheep on what they're going to have for dinner. Under a republic, why if there's laws against eating sheep, and every sheep is armed, that's the difference.
Right. Yeah. And that's it's all very it's upsetting, because for one thing, I have a problem with the Christian. Seems to me that the Christian thought is to support this, you know, our president, and that we all need to get behind him. And I'm thinking, I'm not a liberal, but it seems to me like we're just caught in the crossfires here, because I don't really feel like supporting my president in this and, you know, what he's doing.
Would you say we're sort of between a rock and a hard place?
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to be back here in just a minute. You hang on, Janice, if you'd like to, and we'll be glad to talk to you as soon as we get back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is going to be an open line. If you're out there, a listening audience, and I suspect most of our listeners are glued to the CNN or CBS or watching what's taking place halfway around the world. But if you're out there listening, give us a call at 464-8295. That's 464-8295, or here in the Central Coast of California here across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And of course, we'd like to know what you think about the demonstrations. So, Janice, am I to understand that you are against the demonstrations? Because we're not talking about whether the war is good or bad. We're talking about what do you think about the demonstrations now? Do you think they'll accomplish anything other than divide the country even more? How do you look upon them?
Well, like I said, I look at it as an exercise in futility.
Right.
I think that basically these are people that have some kind of a notion that somehow this is supposed to do something, and I really don't see that how it can. And my personal opinion is that what they're doing is really just a hypocritical kind of a thing, because they feel hate towards George Bush. I don't personally understand that, but I know a lot of people do get their, you know, they just get upset about certain things and they direct it towards the president. You know, I mean, we probably could have said that when Bill Clinton was in office, that, you know, we were really upset with some of the things that went on during his presidency. But we didn't get out there and protest, you know. But I feel like a lot of these people, they just hate George Bush and they hate what he represents. And so they're out there, you know, in the guise of peace. That's, to me, that's not peace. That's what they're doing is not peaceful. You know, they're just out there creating some kind of a way to get attention. I don't really know what they think they're going to accomplish. So, no, I'm not really in favor of it. I'm not really in favor.
All right, fine. So, can I put you down as then the vote against the demonstrations? because we're not, you know, many people may feel the war is wrong, but you feel at least at this point the demonstrations are not going to be very effective.
No, I don't feel they're effective, and I feel that the war is wrong, but I also feel that at this point, you know, the war is going on, and what to me bothers me is that we're all captivated by the, you know, what's going on the news, and we're supposed to be watching this constant information coming out. And I don't know if it's from listening to your program so much. None of it seems like they're telling the truth. I'm looking at it just going, that's not true. And I really, if there's, are there really any journalists there in Baghdad? Because I've read that they were all told to leave.
No, but there's still a few of them over
there's
there. I think that Peter Arnett is going to stay there for a time.
Yeah, but I mean, it's got to be filtered what we're hearing. And
you're absolutely right.
And there's a lot of talking heads. It's a lot of, you know, this and that, and everything is so, I just get tired of it. And it's only 2 days, and it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know what's going to go on. And, you know, I mean, I know that the Lord is in control. God is in control. That's the most important thing. You know, my focus is there, and I don't understand why these things happen all the time, but I do know that that God is in control. And mm-hmm. It says right in I read the scripture a couple days ago, Genesis, and it was talking about the death of Joseph, and Joseph said, actually it was before the death of Joseph, but he said, "Fear not, for I am in the place of God. But as for you who thought evil against me," he was talking to his brothers who, of course, sold him into slavery. He said, "But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring it to pass as it is this day, to save much people. And, you know, I just remembered that through war, through evil, something good comes out of it.
Well, I think that that's a very wise statement. But then, you know, I've always find that the people who rely upon the Bible as a source of information are very wise. Thank you so much,
Thank
Janice.
You. Thank
bye-bye.
You, Dr. Stan. Keep on doing what you're doing.
Hi, well, don't you worry.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Danny. Hi, Danny. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Okay, fine. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, I kind of agree with her as far as, you know, God works through no matter what we put out. But I was really calling to agree with your intimation a few minutes ago that our good King George is looking towards something longer than an eight-year run.
Yeah, right. Well, my concern is, of course, that this is a prelude to other wars. But
oh, well, I'm sure it is.
Those boys, they're American boys. They're our flesh and blood. And you know, pray that this will be a short war. You know, if the war goes on, if war is short, it'll be, you know, at least perhaps do something to help stabilize not only our economy, the economy of the rest of the world. If this war is to go on for a long period of time, it would have a profound impact. Our airlines are crumbling, certainly United Airlines, their overseas flights down 40%. They're already in bankruptcy. If the price of oil were to go up, certainly if there were to be acts of terrorism in this country, why it could be used as a justification for a military dictatorship. And so pray that the war will be very, very quick and that we will not have any acts of violence here. And I don't, my personal opinion, my fear is that that if these demonstrations get out of hand, we will have no alternative but to have a military dictatorship. That's what I think that some people want. That's why I think that these are being well organized and well coordinated. But anything else, Danny?
No, but amen to your prayer there.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And we've got Rory calling from Las Banas. And Rory, I haven't talked to you in I don't know how long. How are you?
I'm fine. I've been out here listening. Don't worry.
Okay, fine. Because we usually get Rory from Watsonville, but not Rory from Las Banas. So.
Well, it's about time.
Okay, fine. It's good to have you with us. Well, this is the time I think everybody feels very deeply, and everybody has strong feelings. So how do you feel about the demonstrations?
Well, in retrospect, like the Vietnam protesters were right, but for the wrong reason. And I think that we have a similar thing going on now. We probably have some people that are protesting what really boils down to death and destruction, but they're doing it for the wrong reason and probably being manipulated by the wrong people.
Okay, I won't disagree with you at all. I think you're absolutely right. The thing is, are they going to accomplish anything?
They're just going to cause division and problems for other people that ordinarily shouldn't be involved in what they're doing.
And you think that maybe what they're doing is going to get a lot more people solidly behind the war than if they just were, because what they're doing is just antagonizing people. And you know, if you're taking a position against the war and you antagonize people, why, they're going to be just rallying increasingly behind the government. Now, right at this point, I think that we should be solidly behind our boys and just hoping and praying this goes as quickly and with as little loss of life as possible. Would you agree?
Oh, I totally agree with that. And one of the things, over dinner tonight with our homeschool children, we were talking about this and how a Christian president could lead our country into a war where there is going to be death and destruction. When the Bible says that follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. And does it make any sense that our Christian, quote-unquote, president would lead our nation into a situation where we were not even attacked by these people, and he's going to cause the death of, you know, thousands and thousands of their people and ours.
But we're going to liberate them, you know. But I wonder if we were to take a vote over there tonight, how many people would vote in favor of being liberated, and how many people would... of course, when we liberate them, we're going to leave 100,000 troops there in Iraq. No question, we're going to leave our troops there for a good long while, because that's what their committee report is called, Rebuilding America's Defenses. You get it up on the website. And if you're up there, and you have, for our listeners, if you have your computer, you go to www.newamericanstrategy.com. newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. And if you don't can't remember it, why, you can call and get a copy of my latest newsletter, and we just give you that website. Go up there, read the Rebuilding America's Defenses report put out in September of year 2000, a year before the September 11th attack, where they talk about how we have to have troops stationed in the Middle East, and that transcends the regime of Saddam Hussein. In other words, it doesn't matter whether he's there or not. We have to have troops in the Middle East, and he is a good excuse for that, but be that as it may, certainly right now, I believe we have to stand behind our troops, and then we'll worry about that once the war is over.
Well, the other thing that alarms me is the terminology, the another war of liberation. I mean, they liberated Cambodia, and they liberated South Vietnam, and a whole string of other countries using wars of liberation, and now here we are using the same terminology as justification for going in there, and your program and your comments have stimulated our thinking of these events to even my kids. They listen to my 13-year-old son quotes Dr. Stan. So you are making an impact, and I want to thank you.
Well, God bless you. Thank you
God
so much. Good night, Roy. And let's go to Joey calling from Capitola. Hi, Joey. How are you doing?
Hey, good. Hey, the protests, I think they're a bit much, the vomiting and such. That's just crossing the line. I don't know, but I think you do have people, you turn on the TV right now, and it feels like I'm in like a Soviet-era news like reporting system or something. There's no real news.
Well, what do they say, you know, in war, the first casualty is truth? Of course it's all propaganda, but, you know, this, they have to. The whole idea is to get the people behind what's going on over there, but every once in a while you'll get some truth. I was watching Brian Williams in Kuwait last night. He was interviewing a four-star general. I don't know if you saw him or not, but, you know, the general was commenting that really how upset the military was because now the Chinese communists had come in and built a whole fiber optic system for the Iraqis in the past. They had to communicate by radio or telephone, and we could always tap into that. But with the fiber optic cables, we can't do that. And so that the Chinese communists had given the Iraqis and that edge as far as their military communication. That was the first time I'd heard about the Chinese communists building the fiber optic network to facilitate the war against America. But then I don't know why I should be surprised. Where did Saddam get the money? He got it by smuggling oil, and we've known he's been smuggling oil all along. He smuggles it to our allies, to Turkey and to Jordan. So why didn't we intervene? Well, if we intervened, he wouldn't have the money to pay the Chinese communists to build the fiber optic network. And it's you look at these things and nothing makes sense. Doesn't make sense. If I'd been Saddam Hussein, I would have gotten out of there, about a week ago with a couple of billion dollars and gone someplace and just asked to be left alone. So why didn't he do that? It's almost like he knows something that nobody else knows.
Yeah, or either maybe that, or maybe he doesn't want, I mean, he's killed his way to the top there, and he's definitely not a soft individual, and maybe he's not willing to, for every night he spent paranoid, wondering if someone's going to poison him or, you know, shoot him at night, maybe he's not willing to just give it up or walk away. And I don't know, we have a debased money, we have taxes that are out of control, we have a service economy, right? No real jobs here. Our Constitution is getting eroded with the Patriot Act. Patriot Act 2 is on the way. We haven't got a terrorist attack on the West Coast yet to snap us into line. I'm kind of waiting for that. And I don't know. I don't know about preemption. Preemption. Now, if we can preemptively strike, cannot our enemy justifiably preemptively strike our country?
Well, but of course, your point is well made. If we have the right to preemptively strike, why shouldn't somebody else have the right to preemptive strike? But see, the trouble is that two wrongs don't make a right.
I would agree, but I'm just saying that other countries and other leaders, even small factions, are going to look at this as like the go-ahead, and they're going to cite reasons why we can preemptively defend against the United States' imperialism, and they'll be able to point to our history. We're not the worst country in the world. I'm not trying to America bash, but they'll be able to point to where we told people to rise up and then let them down. I don't know.
Did you ever stop to think that maybe this whole thing is scripted to turn the world against America? I mean, because America has been the beacon of hope. It's been the city on the hill. It's been the light that people look to of the promise of freedom. And now suddenly the things that are happening now, that light is dimming and people are turning against America. The people in Russia who look to us for hope now look askance at America after what happened in Kosovo. And certainly the Muslim people are turning against us because they feel that this is really a crusade against Muslims as a whole, despite the fact that the president insists it's not. And, you know, we're losing the support of the people in Europe who have traditionally been our allies. Maybe there's another agenda behind what's going on that we don't recognize.
Yeah, you know, it was in 1971 that our currency was truly put into full fiat.
Right.
And, you know, our country, which we call that, you know, the big powerful country that grew free for so long, was built under a free currency. I mean, although we had problems with people trying to steal it constantly, it was generally built under, we gathered up like a third of the world's gold supply. And now, you know, the people, where the gold is in banks. And if it's not worth anything, why do they deposit it? Anyway, that's all I guess I wanted to say.
All right. Now, can I put you, where am I going to put you down as far as the demonstrations? Are
Gosh.
You for them or against them?
I'm for them because we have to have, I mean, they're agitating people. They're getting, you can't watch the news and actually find out what's going on very well. So I would say I'm for them, but for puking and defecating, that's just out of line and outrageous.
Do you think they're going to accomplish anything?
Not doing stuff like that, and that will tend to get the news. So, gosh,
okay.
I don't know. I'm for their right. But
you know, I put you down as a maybe or maybe sort of a neutral on that?
Yeah, I'm for their right to do it. I think their approach is maybe a little misguided.
Okay, thanks so much. Good to hear from you, Joey. And you're right on in everything you said. I certainly agree with you. We've got Harry calling from Redwood City. Hi, Harry. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Fine, thank you. What's your take on how do you feel about the riots and demonstrations?
Well, yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, I certainly hate any kind of you know, violence or looting or you know, and that kind of misbehavior. But you know, in a sense that I think they're right partially. That, you know, they realize, they understand in their hearts that war is madness. I mean, there's no real good, there hasn't been a real good reason for a war in a long, long time. Maybe since the Revolutionary War or to free the slaves. But, you know, it's not going to accomplish anything. I mean, it took huge demonstrations in the 60s. To barely accomplish, I don't think they accomplished anything regarding the Vietnam War. They accomplished something for civil rights, but I don't see the as broad a movement now as I did back then.
All right, fine. So
and the other thing is about the pro-war, but you know, the other thing I admire about the anti-war protesters is that they're dedicated and they're compassionate. They don't want to see people killed, and they're willing to do something and make some kind of sacrifice and express their voice for what they believe in. Whereas I see a lot of people at work and so forth that are pro-war, and they don't want to bother lifting a finger to educate themselves. They just want to bomb all of the Muslims to kingdom come, you know, and just drop nukes everywhere. And it's in a way, it's a very cruel and inhuman attitude.
Well, how about the tactics that they're using, the demonstrations up in San Francisco, you know, getting the newsstands and putting them out in the middle of the streets and blocking traffic and keeping people from getting to work? And is that the way we should be demonstrating, or should we just have a legal march and have the signs and speeches and show our displeasure that way? Do you think that the tactics that are being used today, and especially at this time when our boys are going into battle, we should be supporting the protesters. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, no, I think you're right. I think peaceful demonstrations is the only way to go. I certainly don't favor any kind of blocking people or harassment or this obnoxious behavior.
So do you think that perhaps the demonstrations at this time, as just as the war is getting, may embolden Saddam and the people around him to think that, well, maybe we can do the same thing, you know, that they did in Vietnam. Maybe we can just prolong this war long enough and eventually the Americans will go away. But in the process, you know, an awful lot of Americans, an awful lot of, you know, people over there in Iraq are going to die simply because what they ought to do is just surrender. That would be the logical thing, and because there's no way they can possibly win against our military might. But certainly, do you think we might certainly strengthen the resolve to resist for a time, and which would prolong the war and lead to more in the way of death and destruction?
As far as what the Iraqis?
No, as far as what we're, as far as the anti-war demonstrators here, certainly here in the United States, many people believe that the anti-war movement prolonged the war, and of course emboldened the communists in Vietnam to believe that, you know, that they were going to win because, as many of the people said, you know, we won the war in Southeast Asia, but the war was lost in the streets of America.
Well, I think, you know, the Arabs and so forth are going to do what they're going to do anyway. And, you know, I would really be concerned if there were no protesters, at least no peaceful protesters, because that would show that the American people were totally apathetic. I mean, I understand why they're protesting, but they're going about it the wrong way. I believe, you know, the John Birch Society motto of, you know, education is the key and truth is our only weapon. That is the answer. We have to educate people like you're trying to do to find out, to let them know, you know, what the sinister motives of our leaders are really about with the drive for world government and build enough understanding to change the government. That's really the answer. These little protests by people who have kind of a leftist, you know, viewpoint, is not going to help anything, because when they're not protesting, they're busy agitating for more, you know, like an NGOs at the United Nations for more world government power and so forth.
Okay, fine. Well, thank you so very much for your position, and well said.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And let's go to Pure Heart calling from Aptos. I haven't heard from you in a long time. How are you? Pure Heart? Pure Heart, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Sorry. Oh,
okay.
It took me a while to get to the phone.
Okay, I was a little worried.
Hi. I have a comment and kind of a got another comment after that.
All right, fine.
I kind of know, where is April Glaspy today? Has she been disappeared, do you know? Is she still alive?
Do you want to tell our listeners who April Glaspy was?
Ah, back in 1991 or so when...
1990, maybe.
1990 when George Bush, I guess not senior.
It was George Bush senior.
Yeah, George Bush senior was... planning to do the go to war against Iraq. April Glaspy went to Kuwait or to Iraq to say, if Iraq invaded Kuwait, that'd be none of our business, and you can do what you want, and not our blessing, but we wouldn't bother you.
Well, she basically, and I quoted her in my last newsletter from an article in the Washington Post. She said, "Why, of course, George Bush wants better relationships with you, Saddam. You know, the president is not going to declare an economic war on you over this." Of course, she was telling the truth. He wasn't going to have an economic war. We were going to have a real shooting war. But she didn't tell him that. She misled him. And then, of course, Saddam was not very smart. I say this. He should have been smart enough to realize he was being led into a trap. And instead of that, he invades. Now, he's a wicked and evil and violent man. The world would be better off without him.
Like any partner to the U.S.
He was tricked into going into Kuwait, and of course, once he got in, but even more distressing is once he got into Kuwait and he realized what was going to happen, why didn't he pull out? And that's the thing that has always intrigued me. And I've read some interviews with the generals, Iraqi generals who were there, they were told to dig in and wait for orders, you know, on what to do. And they were expecting orders to come in and say, pull out, get out of here quick before the coalition strikes you.
Uh-huh.
And the orders never came. They were left there to be slaughtered. And so who was Saddam really working for? Was he working for his own people? Why didn't he do it? It was logical once it was obvious that he had been caught in the trap. And I suspect that we do not have the whole story even today.
Well, he figured if he did it, if he was told, unlike Manuel Noriega, he wouldn't be betrayed. And so his speech being betrayed anyway for doing what he was told. But anyway, do you have any pictures of... George Bush Sr. shaking hands with Mr. Hussein, like in the 80s?
I don't have any pictures like that. We do have pictures of Rumsfeld going over and visiting him and back in 1983, but Donald Rumsfeld's forgotten about that. And, of course, we know that that we gave him or allowed him to purchase the chemical and biological weapons here, but Donald Rumsfeld doesn't remember that either. I don't know why. Yeah. I guess he's just certain things he forgets about.
Well, I'm certain he's doing what he's told. He's like he's the supplied enemy. It's all part of just a play, and he'll eventually conveniently disappear someplace safe when it comes down to it, like
the most amazing things. Did you see the pictures that they showed on television last night of Saddam Hussein reading this statement after the attack on his bunker?
No TV in my household, sorry.
Oh, well, they did have pictures in the paper today. And if I ever saw anybody who did not look like Saddam Hussein, it was that fellow. I mean, his face was fuller, his mustache was a different color, and he was supposedly Saddam Hussein. You know, I couldn't help but wonder if either we'd have killed Saddam Hussein, or maybe he and Osama are off on some island someplace having Zachary's course. By this time, Osama's got his beard off, and maybe Saddam's had a little plastic surgery. But I'll tell you, as far as I'm concerned, that man on television, I do not think was Saddam Hussein.
Well, the real Hussein's probably off at Timothy McVeigh somewhere on vacation. But
you really are skeptical.
The thing that's so curious about is, America's squandering its goodwill like crazy, which we had from the Twin Towers collisions. I couldn't figure that out at all.
Did you ever stop to think we're doing that intentionally,
right,
to turn the world against America?
Well, it may not be us, but there's another researcher on KKUP who's named Dave Emery in the Mae Russell School of Thought, and he thinks the Bormann Organization, which left Germany after World War II, did Argentina and whatnot, and is very economically powerful, is actually kind of running things. They want to get rid of the U.S. influence. They still haven't, they're still fighting World War II. And that might explain things if other people would want to bring U.S. down. Cause
I really don't think Morton Bormann is still alive.
But his organization might still exist. But that was his contention.
Well, of course, the thing is...
it could explain why we're squandering all the goodwill so badly.
Well, it could, but then there are lots of explanations out there. The question is it the real explanation?
Yeah, well, I don't know.
All right, well, anyway, anything else you'd like to say, Pure Heart?
Well, it's a horrible time.
They're terrible times. Well, please keep listening, and hopefully as time goes by, but pray for our boys, and pray the war will be over soon.
Will do.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good night.
Bye.
And I just wanted to close with this thought. Back of all that foes have plotted, back of all that saints have planned, back of the schemes by men or demons moves a higher hidden hand. Warp and woof are heaven's making, all the patterns good and wise. Though on earth's sides oft perplexing, clear and right to heavenly eyes. All earth agents act with freedom, choosing whether love or hate, faith in God or bold defiance, none are shackled slaves of fate. Yet that hand that guides is hidden, moving secret and unseen, firmly guiding life's great drama, every act and shifting scene. Even human wrath and knowing serves that all-controlling will. Man proposes, God disposes. All things his design fulfill. To that goal of all the ages, all of history's windings tend, and despite all foes or factions, God proves victor in the end. Mysteries which hurt and baffle, past our power to understand, in the end are turned to blessings by the sovereign's hidden hand. And it's that thought that, of course, keeps me going all the time, and I hope it will tend to actually strengthen you in the days and weeks that lie ahead. We're entering some very, very difficult times for America, but pray for our leaders and understand that we're involved in the spiritual battle. Our job, we're called to do our best. In the final analysis, this is God's battle, but each of you is to be a soldier in that battle, and I think you're going to be asked when you stand before the gates of judgment, what did you do in these times? And not that necessarily this will determine whether or not you're going to get into heaven. We're told you're saved by grace, but certainly I believe God expects us to be involved in the affairs of this earth. So please pray for America and pray for our boys. Pray for the Arabs over there. Pray the battle will be short and swift. And, please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Thanks to everybody who called in tonight. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.
everybody needs to talk. I think that everybody feels better talking. And, you know, there are a couple of people I haven't heard from. And I don't think, I haven't heard from Rory from Los Padres for 3 years.
Right.
And Pure Heart, I haven't heard from in a couple of years anyway.
Wow, shaking the bushes there.
What's that?
Shaking the bushes.
Yeah, well, yeah. But, you know, they feel strongly and understand things.
You know, there was a lady that was on last week that was talking about Bluebird. And
oh, yes, that was Jane.
Okay, right, yeah. And I was thinking, that's why I came in here last week, and I was looking around like, okay, where's the book? I want to see it.
Oh, my God. Anyway, it's just sitting there. I just haven't got a chance to bring it up.
Yeah.
Good book. Excellent book.
Yeah, sounds great. Good. Oh, things are going.
Going well for you?
Yeah, let's just get back from Tahoe and
let's get my sweater here.
Did
you come all the way down here from Tahoe?
Yes.